When what? Asked Patrick. It's only a 12-week course, said Maisie, trying to recover. In 12 weeks' time, said Patrick, my bet is you'll be the one who's giving the classes. What about you? What have you been up to? She asked, as the head waiter came over to tell them their table was ready. Patrick didn't answer the question until they'd sat down at a quiet table in the corner of the room. You may remember I was promoted to deputy manager of the company about 3 years ago, which is why I had to go back to Dublin. I haven't forgotten why you had to go back to Dublin, said Maisie with some feeling. I tried to return to Bristol several times, but once war broke out, it proved almost impossible, and it didn't help that I couldn't even write to you. Well, that problem may well be solved in the near future. Then you can read to me in bed. And how has your company fared during these hard times? Asked Maisie, steering the conversation back onto safer ground. Actually, a lot of Irish companies have done rather well out of the war. Because of the country's neutrality, we've been able to deal with both sides. You're willing to do business with the Germans? Said Maisie in disbelief. No. As a company, we've always made it clear where our allegiances lie. But you won't be surprised to know that quite a few of my countrymen are happy to do business with the Germans. Because of that, we had a couple of tough years. But once the Americans entered the war, even the Irish began to believe the Allies might end up on the winning side. That was her chance to tell Patrick about one American in particular, but she didn't take it. So what brings you to Bristol now? She asked. The simple answer is you. Me? Maisie quickly tried to think of a convincing way of bringing the conversation back onto a less personal footing. Yes. Our managing director will be retiring at the end of the year, and the chairman has asked me to take his place. Congratulations, said Maisie, relieved to be back on safer ground. And you want me to take over as your deputy? She added, trying to make light of it. No, I want you to be my wife. Maisie's tone changed. Didn't it cross your mind, Patrick, just for one moment during the past 3 years, that someone else might have come into my life? Daily, said Patrick, which is why I came over to find out if there was someone else. Maisie hesitated. Yes, there is. And has he asked you to marry him? Yes, she whispered. Have you accepted his proposal? No. But I've promised to let him have my answer before he returns to America at the end of the month, she said more firmly. Does that mean I'm still in with a chance? Frankly, Patrick, the odds are stacked against you. You haven't been in touch for nearly 3 years, and suddenly you turn up out of the blue as if nothing's changed. Patrick made no attempt to defend himself while a waiter served their main courses. I wish it was that easy, he said. Patrick, it was always that easy. If you'd asked me to marry you 3 years ago, I would have happily jumped on the first boat to Ireland. I couldn't ask you then. Maisie put down her knife and fork without taking a bite. I always wondered if you were married. Why didn't you say something at the time? I was so much in love with you, Patrick. I was even willing to suffer that indignity. And to think I only returned to Ireland because I couldn't ask you to be my wife. And has that changed? Yes. Bryony left me over a year ago. She met someone who took more interest in her than I did, which wouldn't have been difficult. Oh my God, said Maisie. Why is my life always so complicated? Patrick smiled. I'm sorry if I've disrupted your life again, but I won't give in so easily this time. Not while I still believe there's even the slightest chance. He leant across the table and took her hand. A moment later, the waiter reappeared by their side, an anxious look on his face as he looked at the two untouched plates of food that had been allowed to go cold. "Is everything all right, sir?" he asked. "No," said Maisie. "It's not." Maisie lay awake and thought about the two men in her life. Mike, so reliable, so kind, who she knew would be faithful until his dying day. And Patrick, so exciting, so alive, with whom there would never be a dull moment. She changed her mind several times during the night, and it didn't help that she had so little time to make her decision. When she came down to breakfast the following morning, her mother didn't mince her words when Maisie asked her, if given the choice, which of the two men she should marry. "Mike," she said without hesitation. "You'll be far more reliable in the long run, and marriage is for the long run. In any case," she added, "I've never trusted the Irish." Maisie considered her mother's words and was about to ask another question when Stan barged into the room. Once he'd gulped down his porridge, he barged into her thoughts. "Aren't you seeing the bank manager today?" Maisie didn't reply. "I thought so. Just make sure you come straight home with my 100 quid. If you don't, my girl, I'll come looking for you." "How nice to see you again, madam," said Mr. Prendergast, as he ushered Maisie into a chair just after 4 o'clock that afternoon. He waited for Maisie to settle before he ventured, "Have you been able to give my client's generous offer some thought?" Maisie smiled. With one word, Mr. Prendergast had given away whose interests he was looking after. "I most certainly have," Maisie replied, "and I would be obliged if you would tell your client that I wouldn't consider accepting a penny less than £400. Mr. Prendergast's mouth opened. "And as it's possible that I might be leaving Bristol at the end of the month, perhaps you'd also be kind enough to tell your client that my generous offer will only remain on the table for 1 week. Mr. Prendergast closed his mouth. "I'll try to drop by again at the same time next week, Mr. Prendergast, when you can let me know your client's decision." Maisie rose from her place and gave the manager a sweet smile before adding, "I do hope you have a pleasant weekend, Mr. Prendergast." Maisie was finding it difficult to concentrate on Mr. Holcomb's words, and not just because the intermediate class was proving far more demanding than the beginners, which she already regretted forsaking. When her hand did go up, it was more often to ask a question than to answer one. Arnold's enthusiasm for his subject was contagious, and he had a real gift for making everyone feel equal and the most insignificant contribution seem important. After 20 minutes of going back over what he called the basics, he invited the class to turn to page 72 of Little Women. Numbers weren't a problem for Maisie, and she quickly turned to the correct page. He then invited a woman in the third row to stand and read the first paragraph, while the rest of the class followed each sentence word for word. Maisie placed a finger at the top of the page and tried desperately to follow the narrative, but she soon lost her place. When the schoolmaster asked an elderly man in the front row to read the same passage a second time, Maisie was able to identify some of the words, but she was praying that Arnold wouldn't ask her to be next. She breathed a sigh of relief when someone else was invited to read the paragraph again. When the new reader sat down, Maisie bowed her head, but she didn't escape. "And finally, I'm going to ask Mrs. Clifton to stand up and read us the same passage." Maisie rose uncertainly from her place and tried to concentrate. She recited the entire paragraph almost word for word without once looking down at the page. But then she had spent so many years having to remember long, complicated restaurant orders. Mr. Holcomb gave her a warm smile as she sat down. "What a remarkable memory you have, Mrs. Clifton." No one else seemed to pick up the significance of his words.
I would now like to move on and discuss the meaning of certain words in that paragraph. In the second line, for example, you'll see the word betrothal, an old-fashioned word. Can anyone give me a more modern example that has the same meaning?
Several hands shot up, and Maisie's would have been among them if she hadn't recognised a familiar, heavy step heading towards the classroom door.
Miss Wilson, said the schoolmaster.
Marriage?
Said Miss Wilson, as the door burst open and Maisie's brother barged into the room. He stopped in front of the blackboard, his eyes darting from person to person.
Can I help you?
Asked Mr. Holcombe politely.
No, said Stan. I've come to collect what's rightfully mine, so keep your mouth shut, schoolmaster, if you know what's good for you, and mind your own business.
His eyes settled on Maisie. Maisie had intended to tell him at breakfast that it would be another week before she found out if Mr. Prendergast's valued customer had accepted her counter-offer. But as Stan walked purposefully towards her, she knew she wasn't going to be able to convince him that she didn't have the money.
"Where's my cash?" he demanded, long before he'd reached her desk.
"I haven't got it yet," said Maisie. "You're going to have to wait another week."
"Like hell I am," said Stan, who grabbed her by the hair and began to drag her, screaming, out from behind her desk.
As he moved towards the door, the rest of the class sat mesmerised. Only one man stood in his path.
"Get out of my way, schoolmaster." "I suggest you let go of your sister, Mr. Tancock, if you don't want to be in even more trouble than you already are." "From you and whose army?" laughed Stan. "If you don't fuck off, mate, I'll knock your teeth right down your throat, and I promise you that won't be a pretty sight."
Stan didn't see the first punch coming, and when it landed in his solar plexus, he bent double, so he could be excused for not recovering before the second blow landed on his chin. The third sent him sprawling to the ground like a felled oak. Stan lay on the floor, clutching his stomach, expecting a boot to be put in. The schoolmaster towered over him and waited for him to recover. When he finally did, Stan rose unsteadily to his feet, never once taking his eyes off the schoolmaster as he edged slowly towards the door. When he thought he was at a safe distance, he looked back at Maisie, who was still lying on the floor, curled up in a ball, sobbing quietly.
"You'd better not come home till you've got my money, my girl," he growled. "If you know what's good for you."
Without another word, he stormed out into the corridor. Even after Maisie heard the door slam, she was still too frightened to move. The rest of the class gathered up their books and slipped quietly out of the room. No one would be visiting the pub that night. Mr. Holcombe walked quickly across the room, knelt down beside his charge, and gathered her trembling body in his arms. It was some time before he said,
"You'd better come home with me tonight, Maisie. I'll make up a bed in the spare room. You can stay for as long as you want to."
Emma Barrington, 1941 to 1942. Chapter 31.
64th and Park, said Emma as she jumped into a taxi outside Sefton Jelks's Wall Street office.
She sat in the back of the cab and tried to think about what she would say to Great Aunt Phyllis when, or if, she got past her front door. But the car radio was so loud that she couldn't concentrate. She thought about asking the driver to turn the volume down, but she had already learnt that New York cabbies are deaf when it suits them, although rarely dumb and never mute. While listening to the commentator describe in an excited voice what had taken place at somewhere called Pearl Harbor, Emma accepted that her great-aunt's first question was bound to be, "What brings you to New York, young lady?" followed by, "How long have you been here?" and then,
Why has it taken you so long to come and see me? To none of these questions did she have a plausible answer, unless she was willing to tell Great Aunt Phyllis everything, something she wanted to avoid because she hadn't even told her own mother everything. She might not even realize she has a great niece, thought Emma. And was it possible there was a long-standing family feud that Emma didn't know about? Or perhaps her great-aunt was a recluse, divorced, remarried, or insane? All Emma could remember was once seeing a Christmas card signed Phyllis, Gordon, and Alistair. Was one a husband and the other a son? To make matters worse, Emma didn't have any proof that she really was Phyllis's great-niece. Emma was even less confident about facing her by the time the cab drew up outside the front door and she'd handed over another quarter. Emma stepped out of the cab, looked up at the imposing four-story brownstone, and changed her mind several times about knocking on the door. She finally decided to walk round the block in the hope that she would feel more confident by the time she returned. As she walked down 64th Street, Emma couldn't help noticing that New Yorkers were scurrying back and forth at an unusually frantic pace with shocked and anxious looks on their faces. Some were looking up at the sky. Surely they didn't believe the next Japanese air raid would be on Manhattan. A paperboy standing on the corner of Park kept shouting out the same headline.
America declares war! Read the latest!
By the time Emma arrived back outside the front door, she had decided she couldn't have picked a worse day to call on her great-aunt. Perhaps it might be wise to return to her hotel and leave it until tomorrow. But why would tomorrow be any different? Her money had almost run out, and if America was now at war, how would she get back to England and, more important, to Sebastian, whom she'd never intended to be apart from for more than a couple of weeks? She found herself climbing the five steps to face a shiny black door with a large, highly polished brass knocker. Perhaps Great Aunt Phyllis was out. Perhaps she'd moved. Emma was about to knock when she noticed a bell in the wall with the word tradesman printed underneath. She pressed the bell, took a pace back, and waited, far happier to face the person who dealt with tradesmen. A few moments later, a tall, elegantly dressed man wearing a black jacket, striped trousers, a white shirt and grey tie opened the door. "How may I help you, ma'am?" he inquired, clearly having decided that Emma wasn't a tradesman. "My name is Emma Barrington," she told him. "I wondered if my great-aunt Phyllis is at home."
"She is indeed, Miss Barrington, Monday being her bridge afternoon. If you'll be kind enough to step inside, I'll let Mrs. Stewart know you're here."
I could always come back tomorrow, if it isn't convenient," stammered Emma. But he'd closed the door behind her and was already halfway down the corridor. As Emma stood waiting in the hall, she couldn't have missed which country the Stewarts hailed from. A portrait of Bonnie Prince Charlie above crossed swords and a Stuart clan shield hung on the wall at the far end of the hall. Emma walked slowly up and down, admiring paintings by Peplow, Ferguson, MacTaggart, and Rayburn. She remembered that her grandfather, Lord Harvey, owned a Lawrence that hung in the drawing room of Mulgerry Castle. She had no idea what her great-uncle did for a living, but he clearly did it well. The butler returned a few minutes later, the same impassive look on his face. Perhaps he hadn't heard the news about Pearl Harbor.
"Madam will receive you in the drawing room," he said.
How like Jenkins he was. No surplus words, an even pace that never varied, and somehow he managed to display deference without being deferential. Emma wanted to ask him which part of England he came from, but knew he would consider that an intrusion, so she followed him along the corridor without another word. She was about to start climbing the stairs when the butler stopped, pulled back a lift grill, and stood aside to allow her to step in. A lift in a private house? Emma wondered if Great Aunt Phyllis was an invalid. The lift shuddered as it reached the third floor, and she stepped out into a beautifully furnished drawing room. If it were not for the noise of traffic, blaring horns and police sirens coming from the street below, one might have been in Edinburgh.
"If you'll wait here, please, madam."
Emma remained by the door while the butler walked across the room to join four elderly ladies who were seated around a log fire, enjoying tea and crumpets, while listening intently to a radio that had never blared. When the butler announced,
"Miss Emma Barrington,"
they all turned and looked in Emma's direction. She couldn't mistake which one of them was Lord Harvey's sister long before she rose to greet her. The flaming red hair, the impish smile, and the unmistakable air of someone who isn't first generation.
"It surely can't be little Emma," she declared as she left the group and sailed across to her great-niece, the hint of a Highland lilt still in her voice. "The last time I saw you, dear girl, you were wearing a gym slip, short white socks and daps and carrying a hockey stick. I felt quite concerned for the little boys playing in the opposing team."
Emma smiled, the same sense of humour as her grandfather.
"And now look at you. Oh, you've blossomed into such a beautiful creature."
Emma blushed.
"So what brings you to New York, my dear? I'm sorry to intrude like this, great aunt,"
Emma began, glancing nervously towards the other three ladies.
"Don't worry about them," she whispered. "After the president's announcement, they've got more than enough to keep themselves occupied. Now, where are your bags?"
"My bag is at the Mayflower Hotel," Emma told her.
"Parker,"
she said, turning to the butler, "send someone round to pick up Miss Emma's things from the Mayflower, and then prepare the main guest bedroom, because after today's news, I have a feeling my great-niece is going to be with us for quite some time." The butler melted away.
"But, great-aunt..."
"No buts," she said, raising a hand. "And I must insist that you stop calling me great-aunt. It makes me sound like an old battle-axe." "Now, it's quite possible that I am an old battle-axe, but I do not wish to be reminded of it on a regular basis, so please call me Phyllis."
"Thank you, great-aunt Phyllis," Emma said.
Phyllis laughed.
"I do so love the English," she said. "Now, come and say hello to my friends. They will be fascinated to meet such an independent young lady, so frightfully modern."
Quite some time turned out to be more than a year. And as each day passed, Emma was more and more desperate to be reunited with Sebastian, but was only able to follow her son's progress from letters sent by her mother and occasionally Grace. Emma wept when she learned of the death of Gramps, because she thought he'd live forever. She tried not to think about who would take over the company and assumed her father wouldn't have the nerve to show his face in Bristol. Phyllis couldn't have made Emma feel more at home if she'd been her own mother. Emma quickly discovered that her great-aunt was a typical Harvey, generous to a fault, and the page defining the words impossible, implausible, and impractical must have been torn out of her dictionary at an early age. The main guest bedroom, as Phyllis called it, was a suite of rooms overlooking Central Park, which came as a pleasant surprise after Emma's cramped single room at the Mayflower. Emma's second surprise was when she came down for dinner on her first evening and found her great-aunt dressed in a flaming red gown, drinking a glass of whiskey and smoking a cigarette in a long holder. She smiled at the thought of being described as modern by this woman.
"My son Alistair will be joining us for dinner," she announced before Parker had been given a chance to pour Emma a glass of Harvey's Bristol cream. "He's a lawyer and a bachelor," she added, "two disadvantages from which he's most unlikely to recover, but at times he can be quite amusing, if somewhat dry."
Cousin Alistair arrived a few minutes later, dressed in a dinner jacket for a meal with his mother, thus embodying the British abroad. Emma guessed that he was around 50, and a good tailor had disguised the fact that he was carrying a few surplus pounds. His humour may have been a little dry, but he was unquestionably bright, fun and well-informed, even if he did go on a bit about the case he was currently working on. It came as no surprise when his proud mother told Emma over dinner that Alistair was the youngest partner in his law firm since the death of her husband. Emma assumed that Phyllis knew why he wasn't married. She couldn't be sure if it was the delicious food, the excellent wine, or simply American hospitality that caused her to relax so much that she ended up telling them everything that had happened to her since Great-Aunt Phyllis had last seen her on a hockey field at Redmaid School. By the time Emma had explained why she crossed the Atlantic, despite the risks involved, they were both staring at her as if she'd just landed from another planet. Once Alistair had devoured the last morsel of his fruit tart and turned his attention to a large brandy, he spent the next 30 minutes cross-examining their unexpected guest, as if he were opposing counsel and she a hostile witness.
"Well, I must say, Mother," he said as he folded his napkin, "this case looks far more promising than Amalgamated Wire versus New York Electric. I can't wait to cross swords with Sefton Jelks."
"What's the point of wasting our time on Jelks," Emma said, "when it's far more important to find Harry and clear his name?"
"I couldn't agree more," said Alistair, "but I have a feeling that one will lead to the other."
He picked up Emma's copy of The Diary of a Convict, but didn't open it, just studied the spine.
"Who's the publisher?" asked Phyllis.
"Viking Press," said Alistair, removing his glasses. "Harold Ginsburg, no less. Do you think he and Max Lloyd might have collaborated in this deception?"
Alistair asked, turning to his mother.
"Certainly not," she replied. "Your father once told me he'd come up against Ginsburg in court. I remember he described him as a formidable adversary, but a man who would never consider bending the law, let alone breaking it."
"Then we're in with a chance," said Alistair, "because if that's the case, he won't be pleased to discover what's been perpetrated in his name. However, I'll need to read the book before I arrange a meeting with the publisher."
Alistair looked across the table and smiled at Emma.
"I shall be fascinated to discover what Mr. Ginsburg makes of you, young lady."
"And I," said Phyllis, "will be equally fascinated to discover what Emma makes of Harold Ginsburg."
"Touché, Mama," Alistair conceded.
After Parker had poured Alistair a second brandy and relit his cigar, Emma ventured to ask him what he thought her chances were of being allowed to visit Harry in Lavenham.
"I'll make an application on your behalf tomorrow," he promised between puffs. "Let's see if I can't do a little better than your helpful detective."
"My helpful detective?" repeated Emma.
"Unusually helpful," said Alistair. "Once he realized Jelks was involved, I'm amazed Detective Kalowski even agreed to see you."
"I'm not at all surprised that he was helpful," said Phyllis, winking at Emma.
Chapter 32.
"And you say your husband wrote this book?"
"No, Mr. Ginsburg," said Emma. "Harry Clifton and I are not married, although I am the mother of his child. But yes, Harry did write The Diary of a Convict while he was incarcerated at Lavenham."
Harold Ginsburg removed the half-moon spectacles from the end of his nose and took a closer look at the young woman seated on the opposite side of his desk.
"I do have a slight problem with your claim," he said, "and I feel I should point out that every sentence of the diary was written in Mr. Lloyd's hand."
"He copied Harry's manuscript word for word."
"For that to be possible, Mr. Lloyd would have had to share a cell with Tom Bradshaw, which shouldn't be difficult to check."
"Or they could have worked together in the library," suggested Alistair.
"If you were able to prove this," said Ginsburg, "it would place my company, and by that I mean me, in an invidious position to say the least, and in the circumstances, I might be wise to seek legal advice."
We would like to make it clear from the start, interjected Alistair, who was sitting on Emma's right, that we came here in a spirit of goodwill, as we felt you would wish to be acquainted with my cousin's story.
It was the only reason I agreed to see you, said Ginsburg, as I was a great admirer of your late father.
I didn't realize you knew him.
I didn't, said Ginsburg. He appeared for the other side in a dispute my company was involved in, and I left the courtroom wishing he'd been on my side. However, if I am to accept your cousin's story, he continued, I hope you won't mind if I ask Miss Barrington one or two questions.
I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, Mr. Ginsburg, said Emma. But may I ask if you've read Harry's book?
I make a point of reading every book we publish, Miss Barrington. I can't pretend I find all of them enjoyable or even finish every one. But in the case of The Diary of a Convict, I knew the moment I'd finished the first chapter that it would be a bestseller. I also made a note in the margin on page 211.
Ginsburg picked up the book and flicked through its pages before beginning to read.
I've always wanted to be an author, and am currently working on an outline plot for the first in a series of detective novels based in Bristol.
Bristol? Said Emma, interrupting the old man. How could Max Lloyd possibly know anything about Bristol?
There is a Bristol in Mr. Lloyd's home state of Illinois, Miss Barrington, said Ginsburg, as Max pointed out when I told him I'd be interested in reading the first in the series.
You never will, Emma promised him.
He's already submitted the opening chapters of Mistaken Identity, said Ginsburg, and I have to say they're rather good.
And were those chapters written in the same style as the diary?
Yes, and before you ask, Miss Barrington, they're also written in the same hand, unless you're suggesting that they were also copied.
He's got away with it once. Why wouldn't he try it on a second time?
But do you have any real proof that Mr. Lloyd didn't write The Diary of a Convict? Said Ginsburg, beginning to sound a little irritated.
Yes, sir. I am the Emma in the book.
If that is the case, Miss Barrington, I agree with the author's judgment that you are indeed a great beauty, and you have already proved, to quote him, to be both spirited and combative.
Emma smiled. And you're an old flatterer, Mr. Ginsburg.
As he wrote, spirited and combative, said Ginsburg, placing his half-moon spectacles back on his nose. Nevertheless, I doubt your claim would stand up in a court of law. Sefton Jelks could put half a dozen Emmas on the witness stand who would swear blind they had known Lloyd all their lives. I need something more substantial.
Don't you find it a little too much of a coincidence, Mr. Ginsburg, that the day Thomas Bradshaw arrives at Lavenham just happens to be the first day of the diary?
Mr. Lloyd explained that he didn't start writing the diary until he became the prison librarian, when he had more time on his hands.
But how do you explain there being no mention of his last night in prison, or the morning he's released? He just has breakfast in the canteen and reports to the library for another day's work.
What explanation do you have? Asked Ginsburg, peering at her over the top of his glasses.
Whoever wrote the diary is still in Lavenham and probably working on the next volume.
That shouldn't be difficult for you to verify, said Ginsburg, raising an eyebrow.
I agree, said Alistair, and I've already submitted an application for Miss Barrington to visit Mr. Bradshaw on compassionate grounds, and am waiting for the warden of Lavenham to give his approval.
May I be allowed to ask a few more questions, Miss Barrington, in the hope of removing any lingering doubts? Asked Ginsburg.
Yes, of course, said Emma.
The old man smiled, pulled his waistcoat down, pushed up his spectacles, and studied a list of questions on a notepad in front of him.
"Who is Captain Jack Tarrant, sometimes known as Old Jack?"
"My grandfather's oldest friend. They served in the Boer War together."
"Which grandfather?"
"Sir Walter Barrington." The publisher nodded.
"And did you consider Mr. Tarrant to be an honorable man?"
"Like Caesar's wife, he was beyond reproach. He was probably the single biggest influence in Harry's life."
"But isn't he to blame for the fact that you and Harry are not married?"
"Is that question relevant?"
asked Alistair, jumping in.
"I suspect we're about to find out," said Ginsburg, not taking his eyes off Emma.
Jack felt it was his duty to alert the vicar to the possibility that my father, Hugo Barrington, might also be Harry's father, said Emma, her voice breaking.
"Was that necessary, Mr. Ginsburg?"
snapped Alistair.
"Oh, yes," said the publisher, picking up the copy of The Diary of a Convict from his desk. "I am now convinced that it was Harry Clifton and not Max Lloyd who wrote this book."
Emma smiled. "Thank you," she said, "even if I'm not sure what I can do about it."
"I know exactly what I'm going to do about it," said Ginsburg. "To start with, I shall release a revised edition as quickly as the presses can print it, with two major changes. Harry Clifton's name will replace Max Lloyd's on the front cover, and his photograph will appear on the back cover. Assuming you have one, Miss Barrington."
"Several," said Emma, "including one of him on the Kansas Star as it sailed into New York Harbor."
"Ah, that would also explain," began Ginsburg.
"But if you were to do that," interrupted Alistair, "all hell will break loose. Jelks will issue a writ on behalf of his client for defamation and claim punitive damages."
"Let's hope so," said Ginsburg, "because if he does, the book will undoubtedly go back to number one on the bestseller lists and remain there for several months. However, if he does nothing, as I suspect will be the case, it will show that he believes he's the only person who has seen the missing exercise book Harry Clifton wrote about ending up in Lavenham."
"I knew there was another one," said Emma.
"There certainly is," said Ginsburg, "and it was your mention of the Kansas Star that made me realize the manuscript Mr. Lloyd submitted as the opening chapters of Mistaken Identity is nothing more than an account of what happened to Harry Clifton before he was sentenced for a crime he didn't commit."
"May I be allowed to read it?" said Emma. The moment Emma walked into Alistair's office, she knew something had gone badly wrong. The familiar warm welcome and gracious smile had been replaced by a furrowed brow. "They're not going to let me visit Harry, are they?" she said.
"No," said Alistair. "Your application was turned down."
"But why? You told me I was well within my rights."
"I phoned the warden earlier this morning and asked him exactly the same question."
"And what reason did he give?"
"You can hear for yourself," said Alistair, "because I made a tape recording of our conversation. Listen carefully, because it gives us three very important clues."
Without another word, he leant forward and pressed the play button on his Grundig. Two spools began to whirl.
"Lavenham Correctional Facility."
"I'd like to speak to the warden."
"Who's calling?"
"Alistair Stewart. I'm a New York attorney."
Silence, followed by another ringing tone. A longer silence, then,
"I'll put you through, sir."
Emma was sitting on the edge of her seat when the warden came on the line.
"Good morning, Mr. Stewart," This is Warden Swanson. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mr. Swanson. I made an application 10 days ago on behalf of my client, Miss Emma Barrington, requesting a visit on compassionate grounds to an inmate, Thomas Bradshaw, at the earliest possible opportunity. I received a letter from your office this morning saying the application has been turned down. I can find no legal reason for...
Mr. Stewart, your application was processed in the usual way, but I was unable to grant your request because Mr. Bradshaw is no longer being held at this establishment.
Another long silence followed, although Emma could see that the tape was still turning. Alistair eventually said,
And which institution has he been transferred to?
I'm not at liberty to disclose that information, Mr. Stewart.
But under the law, my client has the right to...
The prisoner has signed a document waiving his rights, a copy of which I'd be happy to send to you.
But why would he do that?
Said Alistair, casting a line into the water.
I am not at liberty to disclose that information,
repeated the warden, not rising to the bait.
Are you at liberty to divulge anything at all concerning Thomas Bradshaw?
Asked Alistair, trying not to sound exasperated. Another long silence followed, and although the tape was still running, Emma wondered if the warden had put his phone down. Alistair placed a finger to his lips, and suddenly the voice was back on the line.
Harry Clifton was released from prison, but continued to serve his sentence.
Another long pause.
And I lost the best librarian this prison's ever had.
The phone went dead. Alistair pressed the stop button before he spoke.
The warden went as far as he could to assist us.
By mentioning Harry by name, said Emma.
Yes, but also by letting us know he served in the prison library until very recently. That explains how Lloyd got his hands on the diaries.
Emma nodded.
But you said there were 3 important clues, she reminded him. What was the 3rd? That Harry was released from Lavenham, but continues to serve his sentence.
Then he must be in another prison, said Emma.
I don't think so, said Alistair. Now we're at war, my bet is that Tom Bradshaw will be serving the rest of his sentence in the Navy.
What makes you think that?
It's in all the diaries, said Alistair.
He picked up a copy of the diary of a convict from his desk, turned to a page marked by a bookmark and read,
The first thing I'll do when I get back to Bristol is join the Navy and fight the Germans.
But they'd never have allowed him to return to England before he'd completed his sentence.
I didn't say he'd joined the British Navy.
Oh, God, said Emma, as the significance of Alistair's words sank in.
At least we know Harry's still alive, said Alistair cheerfully.
I wish he was still in prison.
Hugo Barrington, 1942 to 1943. Chapter 33. Sir Walter's funeral was held at St. Mary's, Redcliffe, and the late chairman of Barrington Shipping Line would surely have been proud to see such a packed congregation and to hear the heartfelt eulogy delivered by the Bishop of Bristol. After the service, the mourners lined up to offer their condolences to Sir Hugo as he stood at the north door of the church, alongside his mother. He was able to explain to those who asked that his daughter Emma was marooned in New York, although he couldn't tell them why she'd gone there in the first place, and his son Giles, of whom he was inordinately proud, was interned in a German POW camp in Weinsberg, information his mother had passed on to him the previous evening. During the service, Lord and Lady Harvey, Hugo's ex-wife Elizabeth, and their daughter Grace, had all been seated in the front row of the church, on the opposite side of the aisle from Hugo. All of them had paid their respects to the grieving widow, and had then pointedly left without acknowledging his presence. Maisie Clifton had sat at the back of the church, her head bowed throughout the service, and left moments after the bishop had delivered the final blessing. When Bill Lockwood, the managing director of Barrington's, stepped forward to shake hands with his new chairman and to express his condolences, all Hugo had to say was, "I expect to see you in my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning." Mr. Lockwood gave a slight bow. A reception was held at Barrington Hall after the funeral, and Hugo mingled among the mourners, several of whom were about to discover that they no longer had a job with Barrington's. When the last guest had departed, Hugo went up to his bedroom and changed for dinner. He entered the dining room with his mother on his arm. Once she was seated, he took his father's place at the head of the table. During the meal, while there were no servants in attendance, he told his mother that, despite his father's misgivings, he was a reformed character. He went on to assure her that the company was in safe hands and that he had exciting plans for its future. Hugo drove his Bugatti through the gates of Barrington Shipyard for the first time in over 2 years at 9:23 the following morning. He parked in the chairman's space before making his way up to his father's old office. As he stepped out of the lift on the fourth floor, he saw Bill Lockwood pacing up and down the corridor outside his office, a red folder under his arm. But then Hugo had always intended to keep him waiting. "Good morning, Hugo," said Lockwood, stepping forward. Hugo strolled past him without responding. "Good morning, Miss Potts," he said to his old secretary, as if he'd never been away. "I'll let you know when I'm ready to see Mr. Lockwood," he added, before walking through to his new office. He sat down at his father's desk. That was how he still thought of it, and he wondered how long that feeling would last, and began to read the Times. Once the Americans and Russians had entered the war, far more people were beginning to believe in an Allied victory. He put down the paper. "I'll see Mr. Lockwood now, Miss Potts." The managing director entered the chairman's office with a smile on his face. "Welcome back, Hugo," he said. Hugo gave him a fixed stare and said, "Chairman." "I'm sorry, Chairman," said a man who had served on the board of Barrington's when Hugo was in short trousers. "I'd like you to bring me up to date on the company's financial position." "Of course, Chairman." Lockwood opened the red folder he'd been carrying under his arm. As the chairman hadn't invited him to sit, he remained standing. "Your father," he began, "managed to guide the company prudently through troubled times, and despite several setbacks, not least the Germans continually targeting the docks during their nightly bombing raids in the early part of the war, with the help of government contracts, we have managed to weather the storm. So we should be in good shape once this dreadful war is over." "Cut the waffle," said Hugo, "and get to the bottom line. Last year," continued the managing director, turning a page, "the company made a profit of £37,400.10. "Wouldn't want to forget the 10 shillings, would we?" said Hugo. "That was always your father's attitude," said Lockwood, missing the sarcasm. "And this year, our half-yearly results suggest that we're well placed to equal, possibly even surpass, last year's results." Lockwood turned another page. "How many places are currently available on the board?" asked Hugo. The change of subject took Lockwood by surprise, and he had to turn several pages before he could respond. "3, as unfortunately Lord Harvey, Sir Derek Sinclair and Captain Havens all resigned following your father's death." "I'm glad to hear that," said Hugo. "It will save me the trouble of sacking them." "I presume, Chairman, you would not wish me to record those sentiments in my minutes of this meeting?" "I don't give a damn if you do or don't," Hugo said. The managing director bowed his head. "And when are you due to retire?" was Hugo's next question. "I'll be 60 in a couple of months' time, but if you felt, Chairman, given the circumstances..." "What circumstances?" "As you will only just have got your feet under the table, so to speak, I could be persuaded to stay on for a couple more years." "That's good of you," said Hugo, and the managing director smiled for the second time that morning. but please don't put yourself out on my account. 2 months will be just fine by me. So, what's the biggest challenge we're facing at the moment? We have recently applied for a major government contract to lease out our merchant fleet to the Navy, said Lockwood, once he'd recovered. We're not the favourites, but I think your father gave a good account of himself when the inspectors visited the company earlier this year, so we should be taken seriously. When will we find out? Not for some time, I fear. Civil servants aren't built for speed, he added, laughing at his own joke. I have also prepared several discussion papers for your consideration, Chairman, so that you will be well briefed before you chair your first board meeting. I don't anticipate holding that many board meetings in the future, said Hugo. I believe in leading from the front, making decisions and standing by them. But you can leave your briefing papers with my secretary, and I'll get round to them when I find the time. As you wish, Chairman. Within moments of Lockwood leaving his office, Hugo was on the move. I'm going to visit my bank, he said, as he passed Miss Potts's desk. Shall I call Mr. Prendergast and let him know you'd like to see him? Miss Potts asked as she hurried after him down the corridor. Certainly not, said Hugo. I want to take him by surprise. Is there anything you'd need me to do before you return, Sir Hugo? Miss Potts inquired as he stepped into the lift. Yes, see that the name on my door is changed before I get back. Miss Potts turned round to look at the office door. Sir Walter Barrington, chairman, was displayed in gold leaf. The lift door closed. As Hugo drove into the centre of Bristol, he felt that his first few hours as chairman could not have gone better. All was finally right with the world. He parked his Bugatti outside the National Provincial Bank in Corn Street, leant across and picked up a packet he'd left under the passenger seat. He strolled into the bank, past the reception desk, and headed straight for the manager's office, giving a little tap on the door before marching in. A startled Mr. Prendergast leapt up as Hugo placed a shoebox on his desk and sank into the chair opposite him. "I hope I'm not interrupting anything important," said Hugo. "Of course not, Sir Hugo," said Prendergast, staring at the shoebox. "I'm available for you at any time."
"That's good to know, Prendergast. Why don't you begin by bringing me up to date on Broad Street?"
The bank manager scurried across the room, pulled open the drawer of a filing cabinet, and extracted a thick folder which he placed on the table. He sorted through some papers before he spoke again.
"Ah, yes," he said eventually. "Here's what I was looking for."
Hugo was tapping the arm of his chair impatiently.
"Of the 22 businesses which have ceased to trade in Broad Street since the bombing began, 17 have already accepted your offer of £200 or less for their freehold, namely Roland, the florist, Bates, the butcher, Makepeace. What about Mrs. Clifton? Has she accepted my offer?"
"I'm afraid not, Sir Hugo. Mrs. Clifton said she wouldn't settle for less than £400, and has only given you until next Friday to accept her offer."
"Has she be damned?"
"Well, you can tell her that £200 is my final offer. That woman has never had a brass farthing to her name, so I don't expect we'll have to wait too much longer before she comes to her senses."
Prendergast gave a slight cough that Hugo remembered well. "If you succeed in purchasing every property in the street except Mrs. Clifton's, £400 might turn out to be quite reasonable."
"She's bluffing. All we have to do is bide our time."
"If you say so."
"I do say so. And in any case, I know exactly the right man to convince the Clifton woman that she'd be wise to settle for £200.
Prendergast didn't look convinced, but satisfied himself by asking, "Is there anything else I can do to assist you?"
"Yes," said Hugo, removing the lid from the shoebox. "You can deposit this money into my personal account and issue me with a new checkbook."
"Of course, Sir Hugo," said Prendergast, looking into the box. "I'll count it and issue you with a receipt and a checkbook. But I'll need to make an immediate withdrawal, as I have my eye on a Lagonda V12.
"A winner of Le Mans," said Prendergast. "But then you've always been a pioneer in that particular field."
Hugo smiled as he rose from his chair.
Give me a call the moment Mrs. Clifton realizes that £200 is all she's going to get.
Do we still employ Stan Tancock, Miss Potts? Hugo asked as he marched back into the office.
Yes, Sir Hugo, replied his secretary,
following him into the room.
He works as a loader in the stockyard. I want to see him immediately, said the chairman,
as he slumped down behind his desk. Miss Potts hurried out of the room. Hugo stared at the files piled on his desk, which he was supposed to have read before the next board meeting. He flicked open the cover of the top one, a list of the union's demands following their last meeting with management. He had reached number 4 on the list, 2 weeks paid holiday each year, when there was a tap on the door.
Tancock to see you, Chairman.
Thank you, Miss Potts. Send him in.
Stan Tancock walked into the room, removed his cloth cap and stood in front of the chairman's desk.
You wanted to see me, Gov?
He said, looking a little nervous. Hugo glanced up at the squat, unshaven docker, whose beer belly didn't leave much doubt where most of his wage packet went on a Friday night.
I've got a job for you, Tancock.
Yes, Gov,
said Stan, looking more hopeful.
It concerns your sister, Maisie Clifton, and the plot of land she owns on Broad Street, where Tilly's tea shop used to stand. Do you know anything about it?
Yes, Gov. Some geezer offered her £200 for it.
Is that right?
Said Hugo, removing his wallet from an inside pocket. He extracted a crisp £5 note and laid it on the desk. Hugo remembered the same licking of the lips and the same piggy eyes the last time he bribed the man.
I want you to make sure, Tancock, that your sister accepts the offer, without the suggestion that I'm in any way involved.
He slid the £5 note across the desk.
No problem,
said Stan, no longer looking at the chairman, only at the £5 note.
There will be another of those, Hugo said, tapping his wallet, the day she signs the contract.
Consider it done, Gov.
Hugo added casually,
I'm sorry to hear about your nephew.
Don't make much odds to me, said Stan. Got far too big for his boots, in my opinion.
Buried at sea, I was told.
Yeah, more than 2 years back.
How did you find out?
Ship's doctor came to visit my sister, didn't he?
And was he able to confirm that young Clifton was buried at sea?
Sure did. Even brought a letter from some mate who was on board the ship when Harry died.
A letter? Said Hugo, leaning forward. What did this letter say?
No idea, Gov. Maisie never opened it.
So what did she do with the letter?
Still on the mantelpiece, isn't it?
Hugo extracted another £5 note.
I'd like to see that letter.
Chapter 34 Hugo threw on the brakes of his new Lagonda when he heard a paperboy shouting his name from a street corner.
Sir Hugo Barrington's son, decorated for gallantry at Tobruk. Read all about it.
Hugo leapt out of his car, handed the paperboy a halfpenny, and looked at a photograph of his son when he was school captain of Bristol Grammar that dominated the front page. He climbed back into his car, turned off the ignition, and read all about it. Second Lieutenant Giles Barrington of the 1st Battalion, the Wessex, son of Sir Hugo Barrington, Baronet, has been awarded the Military Cross following action in Tobruk. Lieutenant Barrington led a platoon across 80 yards of open desert, killing a German officer and 5 other soldiers, before overrunning an enemy dugout and capturing 63 German infantrymen from Rommel's crack Africa Corps. Lieutenant Colonel Robertson of the Wessex described Lieutenant Barrington's action as displaying remarkable leadership and selfless courage in the face of overwhelming odds. Second Lieutenant Barrington's platoon commander, Captain Alex Fisher, also an old Bristolian, was involved in the same action and mentioned in dispatches, as was Corporal Terry Bates, a local butcher from Broad Street. Lieutenant Giles Barrington, MC, was later captured by the Germans when Rommel sacked Tobruk. Neither Barrington nor Bates is aware of their award for gallantry, because both of them are currently prisoners of war in Germany. Captain Fisher has been reported as missing in action. Full story, pages 6 and 7. Hugo sped home to share the news with his mother.
How proud Walter would have been, she said once she'd finished reading the report. I must call Elizabeth immediately, in case she hasn't heard the news.
It was the first time anyone had mentioned his former wife's name for a long while.
I thought you'd be interested to know, said Mitchell, that Mrs. Clifton is wearing an engagement ring.
Who would want to marry that bitch?
Mr. Arnold Holcombe, it seems.
Who's he?
A schoolmaster.
Teaches English at Merriwood Elementary. In fact, he used to teach Harry Clifton before he went to St. Bede's.
But that was years ago. Why haven't you mentioned his name before?
They've only recently met up again, when Mrs. Clifton began attending evening classes.
Evening classes? Repeated Hugo.
Yes, said Mitchell. She's been learning to read and write. Seems she's a chip off the young block.
What do you mean? Snapped Hugo.
When the class took their final exam,